deadly escalation in Lebanon, intensified airstrikes between Israel and Hezbollah stoke fears of a broader conflict in the Middle East. Analysis on the latest developments and what's next for the region.
We're here in South Florida to bring you a story about protecting the Everglades. Come along in this boat. We've got a story for you coming up.
The intersection of the environment and politics. We travel to Florida to see firsthand the fragile coexistence of man and nature, and to learn what political leaders on both sides of the aisle are doing to protect our common home. Pope Francis is on the road again, this time closer to home in Belgium and Luxembourg. We'll tell you what he's hoping to accomplish on his latest mission abroad.
I hope that this music points towards something heavenly, and that people are reminded of the merciful love of God.
And inside the creative mind, singer-songwriter Marie Miller shares the Catholic inspiration that brings her listeners so much joy. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I left Syria in 2014 because of the war. We went to South Lebanon and lived and worked there. Then this latest war in the South started. There were too many strikes and there was a lot of destruction. So we left the South because of the strikes. We barely made it. We've been on the road for 3 days.
Chaos at the Syria-Lebanon border as people desperately try to escape aerial bombardment from Israel in the South. The United Nations estimates more than 90,000 families have made the journey to evade what has been the deadliest week in Lebanon since 2006. Just on Friday afternoon, large explosions rocked the Lebanese capital of Beirut. The Israeli military says it targeted and hit the headquarters of Hezbollah, where many of their leaders stay. Large plumes of smoke were seen rising into the air in the aftermath of the strikes. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Tensions between Israel and the militant group Hezbollah have simmered for months, but the conflict between the two has now entered a new chapter, inciting fears of a full-blown war in the region.
I have a message for the people of Lebanon. Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah.
On Monday morning, people in southern Lebanon woke up to a rare message from Israeli Defense Forces. Evacuate your homes.
Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now.
What followed that warning was an airstrike, the biggest and deadliest Lebanon has faced from Israel in nearly two decades. On that day alone, Israel fired at more than 1,000 targets, aiming at weapons and infrastructure of the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah. Universities and schools across the country were converted into shelters. Thousands of cars gridlocked roads into the capital of Beirut, desperate to escape the line of fire. And throughout the day, the death toll continued to climb. Lebanese officials say more than 500 people have been killed from the strike, including women, children, and medical personnel. Thousands of others were left wounded, tens of thousands displaced.
We were living in Burj al Shamali. I was working and was on my motorcycle when they hit. I was injured by the strikes.
Tension started to boil between Israel and Hezbollah in October of last year after the Hamas terror attack in Israel. Hezbollah began firing missiles into Israel in solidarity with its ally, Hamas, and promised to keep doing so until Israel ended its campaign in Gaza. Since then, Israel and Hezbollah have exchanged near daily fire at their border. More than 60,000 Israelis have been forced to evacuate their homes.
Hezbollah's aggression left Israel with only one single option, and that is to massively retaliate against Hezbollah's aggression.
The tension escalated to a new high last week when pagers and two-way radios owned by Hezbollah members spontaneously exploded, killing dozens of people and wounding thousands. Hezbollah blames Israel on the bugged devices, though it has not confirmed nor denied responsibility. Then, on Friday, an Israeli strike collapsed a residential building and killed more than 30 people, including a senior Hezbollah commander. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is intensifying its offensive on Hezbollah to allow displaced Israelis to return home.
I promised that we would change the security balance, the balance of power in the north. This is exactly what we are doing. We are destroying thousands of missiles and rockets aimed at Israeli cities and Israeli citizens.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, promised Hezbollah would claim ultimate victory over Israel.
They martyred some effective and precious members of Hezbollah. This was a damage to Hezbollah, no doubt. But this was not a damage to bring Hezbollah to its knees. Hezbollah's organizational and human structure is much too strong to be broken with such things.
The intensified offenses leave some political analysts concerned that the conflict could turn into a broader war in the Middle East. Farhad Rezai, senior fellow at the Philos Project, says Iran cannot afford a full-scale war.
Iranians have a lot of problems. They are facing lots of crises. The regime is facing economic crisis. It faces legitimacy crisis, social crisis. And obviously, it's not in a position to rescue Hezbollah. They either have to address the Israeli security concerns or face the consequence. I don't think there are other options around for Hezbollah.
But retired Marine Colonel Eric Boer believes the proxy war between Israel and Hezbollah could continue.
I don't know how much more it can be heightened. The rhetoric is going to continue to be heightened. But until the Iranians are willing to back down of their support, it's going to sit at this stalemate for the foreseeable future.
The unfolding conflict loomed over the United Nations General Assembly in New York this week. Many global leaders condemned Israel for its attack against Lebanon, even as Netanyahu prepared to address the group on Friday.
If terrorists turned El Paso and San Diego into ghost towns, then ask yourself, how long would the American government tolerate that? A day? A week? A month? I doubt they tolerated even for a single day. Yet Israel has been tolerating this intolerable situation for nearly a year. Well, I've come here today to say enough is enough.
A fiery Netanyahu was met with cheers and jeers as he addressed the United Nations Friday morning, defending Israel's offensive in Lebanon as well as Gaza. The controversial figure used his speech to, quote, set the record straight. He likened his country's wars to a battle between good and evil and promised to persist until Israel's objectives are met. Netanyahu condemned the UN for not supporting Israel, calling it a swamp of anti-Semitic bile. For analysis, we turn to Alberto Fernandez, vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute. He previously served as an ambassador and diplomat with the U.S. State Department. Alberto, welcome back to our program. The Israeli military is now preparing for a possible ground invasion in southern Lebanon. What's your reaction to that, and is it necessary for Israel to accomplish its goals?
Well, what we've seen, I think, especially over the last few days, is that Israel is able to accomplish a lot of its goals without a ground invasion. Ground invasion is kind of what Hezbollah expected or prepared for. And what we've seen in the past 10 days or so, and even before, we've seen Israel be extraordinarily effective in kind of in its intelligence work and in its air campaign. So it's actually accomplishing a lot of its goals without putting one soldier at risk on the ground in Lebanon.
And can you clarify, why is Israel focusing on Hezbollah right now? Hasn't their focus been on Hamas since October 7th?
Well, of course, Hamas originated the conflict on October 7th, but Hezbollah joined on October 8th. And since then, 9,000 Hezbollah rockets have fallen on Israel and wounded and injured people, civilians, including children, killed 12 children just a few weeks ago. So it's been a pending issue. The Israelis had to deal with the immediate problem or the immediate challenge of Hamas's invasion on October 7th. But Hezbollah was able, after, you know, starting on October 8th, to kind of impose a kind of empty swath of Israeli territory. 60,000-70,000 Israelis had to flee from their homes. So this has been a long time coming. It's not completely unexpected that this was going to happen.
How do you see this conflict expanding? Do you think this could turn into a broader war in the Middle East, particularly with Iran?
Well, you know, it's kind of a broad war already. Israel's been hit from six different locations, from Gaza, from Lebanon, from Syria, from Iraq, from Iran itself, and from Yemen. So it's kind of already a broad war. What it isn't is, of course, it doesn't have the intensity of a broader war. There's a challenge now, which is Israel seems to be winning on the battlefield militarily. And Iran created these proxies, including Hezbollah, as a kind of safety network for Iran's ambitions in the region and for Iran to use at some point in the future, say when Iran gets nukes, if Iran gets nukes. So what the Israelis are doing is kind of messing with the Iranian timeline, kind of getting ahead of what the Iranians and what Hezbollah wanted to do. And that presents a real existential security challenge for Iran.
Absolutely. And Israel's strikes on Lebanon are some of the deadliest in decades. What could a broader conflict mean for Lebanon?
Well, it's a tragedy and a disaster for Lebanon. Lebanon is a country which is already in deep, you know, deep disaster mode. You know, it's economically bankrupt. It has no government, has no president. It's riven by, you know, all kinds of social, economic, and political problems. Hezbollah is a cancerous growth on Lebanon, and the Christians of Lebanon are very much hemmed in and besieged by Hezbollah. So it couldn't have come at a worse time for the Lebanese people, but of course, they didn't have a vote in it, right? It's Hezbollah decided, because it's an ally, because it's a proxy of Iran, to join a war it could have avoided on October 8th.
The United States, along with a handful of other nations, are pushing a 21-day ceasefire in Lebanon. But Netanyahu has distanced himself from that proposal. What sway does the U.S. have in this conflict right now?
You know, it has some sway. We're the United States. But, of course, you know, there's a kind of boy who cried wolf kind of thing. Is the U.S. has been putting pressure on Israel for a long time, and Israel has its own agenda and has its own worldview and has its own foreign policy goals. And the Americans kind of want to tamp things down without addressing the root causes that Israel wants to address. And so you have this kind of space that has appeared between the Biden administration's goals and the Netanyahu government's goals right now. Israel sees this as an opportunity to settle accounts with its enemies, which have a lot of Israeli and, mind you, a lot of American blood on their hands.
Just expanding on that, do you think a diplomatic solution between Israel and Hezbollah could be possible?
I think it will be possible, but I think, unfortunately, there's still going to be a bit more of back and forth violence and bombing before we reach that point. I hope that that point of diplomacy happens sooner rather than later.
And while I have you, Alberto, you know, you explained that Hezbollah is a key ally for Iran. Can you expand even more why Iran has been reluctant to directly intervene in this conflict?
Iran is reluctant because Iran has its own kind of time frame for what it wants to do in the region. Iran feels that it's not ready to challenge Israel directly. It created this network of proxies so that it would have plausible deniability. It's not us. It's the Iraqis or the Lebanese. We're not doing anything. And all of that is kind of broken down. So Israel has kind of upset the clock that Hezbollah had with these proxies. They wanted them to take the heat and Iran to sit back. And what's Hezbollah doing now? Hezbollah is calling on Iran to intervene. But Iran created Hezbollah so that it wouldn't have to intervene directly, so that it could use Hezbollah as a tool. That's the problem.
Well, we are so grateful for your expertise and your insight on this as we continue to watch the developments closely. Alberto Fernandez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And while we focus on the Middle East and comments at the United Nations about tensions there, concern about Ukraine was also at the forefront of the UN. Before traveling to New York to address member nations, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited a Pennsylvania munitions factory producing artillery shells for Ukraine's war against Russia. He expressed his gratitude to workers and said, "We need more." Zelensky spoke at the UN later in the week before visiting with President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris on Thursday in Washington and with former President Donald Trump on Friday in New York. Stay right there. There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth.
As a Catholic school, we need to be aware of our environment. We need to protect it.
The environment and politics. We go to the Everglades and a Florida Catholic school renowned for its environmental education to learn how care for our common home is being reflected in our political leaders. A faith-filled look at the difficult subject of suicide during this National Suicide Prevention Month. A Catholic bishop shares his personal story and the need for mental health ministry in our church.
One of my favorite quotes now of all time by Therese, and she says, "How sweet is the way of love." And just that beginning line, I thought that would be really cool for a song.
And her devotion to Saint Therese motivates this Catholic musician to compose her new album. Marie Miller's beautiful music and her personal faith journey. A little later on EWTN News in Depth.
Will former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris debate one more time before the election on November 5th? Last weekend, Harris accepted a debate proposed by CNN on October 23rd. Trump is on the record saying there will not be another debate and said last weekend it was too late, that early voting has already begun. However, political observers say if the polls remain tight with a slight edge to Harris, it is possible Trump might need another debate to speak to a wide cross-section of voters. There is one more confirmed debate, this one between the vice presidential candidates, Democrat Tim Walz and Republican J.D. Vance. The Walz-Vance debate is scheduled just a few days from now on Tuesday, October 1st. It will be hosted by CBS News in New York City and will air from 9 to 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time. With less than 40 days until November 5th, both candidates visited key battleground states to make their case on a key issue for voters, the economy. Trump began his week by speaking to a group of farmers in rural Pennsylvania. He also visited a local grocery store where he decried the higher food prices. Trump emphasized his plan to maintain U.S. dominance over foreign competitors and argued that imposing tariffs and increasing energy production will lower costs for Americans. Meanwhile, Harris offered her own vision of the economy. In Pennsylvania on Wednesday, she spoke of her economic plan and emphasized her focus on supporting the middle class and entrepreneurs. She then sat down with MSNBC for her first solo television interview since beginning her campaign, fielding questions about her economic policies. Harris ended her week with a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, hoping to win other voters in another key issue, immigration. A new national poll indicates the American people do not see either candidate as particularly religious. Harris is a Baptist who is influenced by religious traditions in her mother's home country of India. Trump grew up as a Presbyterian, but began identifying as a non-denominational Christian near the end of his presidency. In this latest survey, only 14% of U.S. adults say the word Christian describes Harris or Trump extremely or very well. The Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs poll was conducted in mid-September. Among Trump's most ardent supporters, white evangelicals, 7 in 10 view him favorably, yet just 2 in 10 within this group associate the word Christian with him. Among black Protestants who largely support Harris, about 7 and a half in 10 view her favorably, and about 4 in 10 describe her as Christian. While politics can often divide, the state of Florida has seen unity around an unexpected issue, the environment. The Everglades are essential to millions of state residents. Our Catholic faith calls us to be good stewards of the earth. And in South Florida, correspondent Mark Irons found people working to preserve God's creation.
What's going to happen if we use all the resources and we don't protect them?
We're fighting each and every day to protect what's left.
The Everglades in South Florida make up the largest subtropical wilderness in the United States. Views from the air or water give you a sense of the magnitude and majesty of the region. Bursting with plant and animal life, it's a vast aquatic ecosystem, and millions of people depend on it.
We're told there are many reasons to protect and preserve the Everglades. It's a crucial habitat for rare and endangered species. But it's not just about the animals that call this place home. Right now, we're surrounded by a major source of drinking water for the people that call Florida home.
The Everglades is the source of drinking water for a third of the state population. So it's desperately important that we address the challenges.
Eric Eichenberg, the CEO of the Everglades Foundation, an advocacy group focused on science and education, says preserving this grassy freshwater oasis is even more important when you consider its history. Most of it is gone.
We have about a third of it left, and that's because of development here in the state of Florida.
For thousands of years, freshwater moved south from central Florida through lakes, rivers, and channels, replenishing the Everglades. But that natural flow was significantly altered beginning in the late 1800s. With calls to drain the swamp, water was redirected to the east and west coasts to make room for massive development projects. And in the process, two-thirds of the Everglades was wiped out, wreaking havoc on a wildlife refuge and drying up much of a critical water source.
These are man-made issues that we're trying to address.
For decades now, ongoing engineering projects to return the flow of fresh water back to the south have been underway to try and fix some of the problems created in the past.
This generation now is ensuring that we save what's left and then we pass that on to the next generation.
What's happening in South Florida calls to mind something that St. John Paul II spoke about when he was Pope: the relationship between human activity and the whole of creation. In a 1990 address to celebrate the World Day of Peace, he said, "We cannot interfere in one area of the ecosystem without paying due attention both to the consequences of such interference in other areas and to the well-being of future generations."
If we're going to develop the land, we need to be able to do it with wisdom. We want to care for the created order because God cares for it, because he's holding it in existence at every single moment.
Biology professor Brett Fager at Ave Maria University in South Florida says protecting the Everglades or other natural environments has a spiritual dimension.
If we don't have these places for ourselves and for future generations, then you're kind of robbing people of the ability to experience the creator in his creation.
Dr. Evelyn Geiser can relate to that idea. An aquatic ecologist at Florida International University, she's Lutheran and grew up exploring the outdoors.
And for me, it's always been a way of experiencing my faith and the incredible wonder of creation.
Now, Geiser has spent almost three decades conducting scientific research in the Everglades. She says the fresh water builds up the soil and vegetation here, creating a natural buffer against tropical storms and the rising sea levels caused by climate change. Geiser says the saltwater intrusion harms the vegetation growth and soil buildup, which is why directing more fresh water into the region is essential.
Bringing more fresh water into the Everglades allow them to continue building soils, maintaining that buffer both against sea level rise and against tropical storms.
Following St. John Paul II, Pope Benedict XVI echoed the environmental concerns of his predecessor. In 2010, he drew attention to the global water cycle system, which is of prime importance for life on Earth and whose stability could be seriously jeopardized by climate change. A pope, professor, or scientist could all share concerns about different environmental issues. In the end, people might still divide along political lines.
No matter what side of the aisle you walk on, we need to protect these ecosystems.
In Florida, Everglades restoration has enjoyed bipartisan support. Eichenberg says the state economy relies on fresh water, and people see the necessity of preserving it.
When they turn on their tap, take a shower, recreate in their pool, wash their car, that water is coming from America's Everglades.
At the state and federal level, Republicans and Democrats have taken action. Most recently, Governor Ron DeSantis announced $850 million to Everglades restoration projects in the state budget. Previously, President Joe Biden announced $1.1 billion for restoration in his infrastructure bill. Future generations will depend on the Everglades.
I think it's important that as Catholics, our children learn the importance of protecting our earth, our environment.
St. Michael the Archangel Grade School in Miami is one of many schools in South Florida that teamed up with the Everglades Foundation to incorporate educational lesson plans into the classroom. But the principal, Lisette Reyna Naranjo, was surprised to learn they were the only Catholic school that signed up.
I thought, wow, I wonder why none of the Archdiocese schools have ever even thought of doing that.
Following the lead of the two popes before him, Pope Francis says we need to care for creation, especially since innocent human lives are at stake. In 2015, he wrote, "In fact, the deterioration of the environment and of society affects the most vulnerable people on the planet." Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Florida is reeling after Hurricane Helene made landfall Thursday night. The Category 4 storm battered several southern states with catastrophic winds and a deadly storm surge. We'll bring more coverage of the storm still ahead in our broadcast. Next, we turn to a difficult topic that sadly affects thousands of families across the country, the tragedy of suicide. A U.S. Catholic bishop with his own family story of loss tells us how faith can provide strength during this unthinkable grief. We'll be right back.
So we don't give up. We trust. Those of you who are survivors of suicide loss, you've done all things well. Don't lose heart. Don't question. And if you should question, really rethink that.
That is Bishop John Dolan of Phoenix earlier this month celebrating the third annual Mass of Remembrance for those who have died by suicide. September is National Suicide Prevention Month and a topic that has touched the life of Bishop Dolan personally. Bishop Dolan is a survivor of suicide loss, having lost three siblings and a brother-in-law to suicide. The Centers for Disease Control says suicide is a leading cause of death today and has become a serious public health problem. Suicide rates increased approximately 36% between the years 2000 and 2022. It was responsible for more than 49,000 deaths in 2022 alone. Bishop John Dolan of Phoenix established the Office of Mental Health Ministry in his diocese in 2022. He joins us now to discuss this tough issue, his family story, and what more the church can do to address the rising rates of suicide. Your Excellency, thank you for coming on to speak about this difficult topic. You were only in eighth grade when your first sibling died by suicide. Do you mind sharing more about how this type of tragedy has impacted your life over the years?
Well, over the years, yes, it has impacted my life. There's no doubt about it. When my brother died, he was probably 19 years old, I believe, and hanged himself. And my family, of course, we were very Catholic. We went to Catholic school. We were attending Catholic Mass. We were altar servers. The faith was very, very powerful in our family life. It was just an essential part of our family. Church was really an extension of our home. But when Tom died by suicide, he was getting into some, troubles with drugs and then ultimately the law. And all of that led to a level of despair. But we weren't aware of the wholeness of this, the whole aspect of this. Mm-hmm. We had no sense in the 70s that this would have had we were talking about mental health related mm-hmm. issues. Mm-hmm. This wasn't something you would talk about either. And so for me as a child, we sort of kind of clammed up. My parents clammed up. My folks wouldn't ever really talk about it. And we did as well. And that came back to haunt each and every one mm-hmm. of us in our family in one way or another. So it has had an impact over the course of my life. Yeah.
And after your brother, Tom, your sister, Therese, I believe was a Catholic school teacher when she died yeah. by suicide. Bishop, that might surprise people that someone who is practicing the faith can still die by suicide. Can you address that and other misconceptions people might have on this topic, especially within the church?
Yeah, I think there's the thing about suicide or mental health. It's a mental health specifically may or may not be an actual physical reality, but often it is. So that's something that we as a family had to grasp over a period of time. Again, we weren't aware of that. Now, the beautiful thing about faith and science is they both lead to God. That's mm-hmm. our Catholic tradition. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, we really didn't have a sense of how that science worked for us in our life. And so we would just simply say, well, you know, be a good Catholic, be a good, you know, pray, have your devotions, all of which was a part of our lives. And mm-hmm. my sister Therese was very profoundly devoted. She was a regular attendee in her married life and attended Sunday Mass, and she participated in her parish school where she was a teacher of art, and she was very vibrant in many ways. And yet, as we were waiting for her to come home for Thanksgiving along with her husband, we discovered that the coroner showed up instead, and mm-hmm. That was devastating for the entire family, as you can imagine.
I can't.
But the faith is one aspect. It's an aspect. We want to pray. Of course, we have to. We have to go to God. But what we've discerned over great studies, there are great studies showing that, religion may be a social determinant of health, but there's a difference between, say, ideation. People might have suicidal ideation. They're thinking about that. And they may be going to church, participating in the life of the church, and you would never know that they're thinking about suicide. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, those who aren't practicing their faith, they may be affiliated to faith, to some kind of a church, they will have a greater chance of, acting on that ideation than a person who is participating, say, in the life of the church. Mm-hmm. And that's why mental health ministry mm-hmm. is so essential for me.
Absolutely. And I should mention your sister, Mary Elizabeth, died more recently, I think closer to two years ago from suicide. And Bishop, I imagine this type of tragedy is one you just look up and ask, why, God, why? And yet you kept your faith in God. And you discerned the priesthood.
Yes. I was discerning the priesthood, before my sister Therese had died. She was, I was a junior in the college seminary at the time. And then after I was ordained a priest, my sister Mary was showing all the signs of a desire to die. Mm. And in fact, she had attempted multiple times. I had never met a person who wanted to live as much as Mary wanted to live every day. Mm. Can you imagine just getting up and thinking, how am I going to try to get through this day without killing myself? Mm. I mean, it was such a tragic thing. And she ultimately did that shortly after I became bishop here in Phoenix. Mm. Yeah.
We just have a little bit left, Your Excellency, but I did want to ask if there's someone who is watching right now who is feeling despair, who's feeling darkness, what message do you have for them?
Well, I would say the first is don't give up hope. You know, every hope, as Pope Francis is encouraging us in this coming Jubilee year, it's a year of hope. We need to find those benchmarks of hope and hang on to them, but we can't go it alone. Talk about it with somebody. Allow someone else to assist you in this virtue of hope. Hope is a virtue, and we have to rely on that, but we can't do it alone. It's like an alcoholic who just cries in his or her pillow every night to God, but never goes to say AA or reach out to someone. That person is never going to get to a step toward recovery. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true for people who may be struggling with suicidal ideation or just depression or other mental health related issues. Reach out to someone, talk about it. Don't be afraid about it. People are talking about it more and more today. And I think that's great because it's going to lower the stigma. So don't be afraid.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for all that you're doing to change that stigma. Thank you for your vulnerability and your leadership on this issue. Bishop Dolan, God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
From one bishop's personal story about suicide loss to another's, retired Bishop Joseph Strickland, whom Pope Francis removed as head of the Diocese of Tyler, Texas last year, is opening up in a new way about losing his older brother to suicide when he was a teenager. In an audio conversation hosted by REM Counseling between National Catholic Speaker and licensed counselor Sister Josephine Garrett and Strickland, the retired bishop says losing his brother to suicide shaped his priestly ministry and how he cares for the faithful today.
When you're able to tell someone that you know how it feels to lose a loved one in suicide, they know.
Yeah.
They know. You aren't just saying things out of a pastoral manual. You're speaking from the heart.
The conversation between the retired bishop and the Catholic counselor was conducted in light of Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. If you or someone you love is in immediate crisis, help is available by calling or texting 988. That is the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. For those experiencing deep feelings of despair, counseling help is also available through your local diocese. And turning to the power of prayer, the U.S. Bishop's National Catholic Mental Health Campaign announced this week it will lead a novena for mental health starting on October 10th. More information about the campaign and the upcoming novena can be found at usccb.org/mental health. We will be right back with top news in the Week in Review. Homes flooded and on fire in Florida after Hurricane Helene, a Category 4 storm, slammed into the western coast and panhandle Thursday night. This story tops our Week in Review. The flooding is being called historic. Cars, homes, and entire neighborhoods have been submerged with muddy waters. This aerial view of the city of Tampa shows streets have turned into rivers. In some areas, boats were thrown ashore onto the docks and even onto front lawns. Roads are covered in debris and mud. Multiple people had to be rescued overnight and into the morning. This video from the Clearwater, Florida Fire Department shows an elderly woman being carried through waist-high water and others loading onto a truck to be brought to shelter. Rescue operations are continuing in cities and towns throughout the South. Reports are that more than 20 people have died in this storm. More than 4 million are without power across Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia. Fears are that outages may last for weeks. Pope Francis is on the road again, traveling this week to Luxembourg and Belgium. The Holy Father's apostolic journey centers around evangelization as he toured two European nations steeped in Christian tradition but experiencing widespread secularization. Windy and rainy weather did not keep Pope Francis from meeting with politicians and visiting Luxembourg's 17th century cathedral on Thursday. He then flew to Belgium, where the king and queen gave him a royal welcome on the tarmac. On Friday, the Holy Father spoke with Belgian dignitaries on the church's longstanding clerical abuse crisis in the country. The Belgian prime minister demanded concrete steps for abuse victims. Pope Francis emphasized the church must seek forgiveness.
Today, words alone do not suffice. We also need concrete steps. Victims need to be heard. They need to be at the center.
A scourge that the church is addressing firmly and decisively by listening to and accompanying those who have been wounded and by implementing a prevention program throughout the world.
Pope Francis later visited students and faculty at the Catholic University of Leuven in honor of its 600th anniversary. He will remain in Belgium through the weekend before returning to Rome. The second and final Vatican Assembly for the Global Synod on Synodality will kick off next week. It's the culmination of a years-long process of listening and discernment within the global church. This October session will build off of last year's discussions among the bishops, religious, and lay people who attended. The working document for this year's session focuses on concrete ways to enhance the participation and mission of the church. Controversial topics, such as the female diaconate, will not be addressed this year, as they were in 2023. They have instead been delegated to specialized study groups for further examination. An important voice at the synod is an influential archbishop from Africa who believes synodality is the way forward for the Catholic Church. A member of the Vatican Synod Council, Archbishop Andrew Nkia, is not shy about his views of prior synod meetings and what he's hoping for next as the synod meetings recommenced. He spoke recently to our Monse Alvarado. Here is Archbishop Andrew Nkia of Cameroon on the record.
And has your experience then in the Synod this first round, and now we're gearing up for the upcoming gathering again in October, has that experience, what has it been like? What was it like for you going to the Synod? Were you prepared for what you would see?
Again, I must go back to the beginning. I am a member of the Synod Council. After the Synod of 2018 on the youth, which produced Christus Vivit, I was elected a member of the Synod Council. And therefore, the work of the Synod Council is to help the Holy Father prepare for the next Synod. So from the very beginning, from the choice of topic, from drafting the early documents, I've been involved. And therefore, the Synod did not come to me as a surprise, because we were involved from the very beginning, working together with the Holy Father. And synodality is something I believe in. Synodality is the way forward for our church. Holding hands together and moving forward. But you discover that from the time synodality was conceived as a topic for the next synod until the first phase of the synod, there has been a lot of evolution. There are many things that are being talked about now that has absolutely nothing to do with synodality. In synodality, everybody respects everybody. We hold our hands together. We are all moving towards the kingdom of God. It has nothing to do with doctrine. It has nothing to do with governance in the sense of who is oppressing who. But when you look at synodality as a form, a new way of being church, nobody is left behind. Together, we begin to work from the family level to the mission station level, to the small Christian communities, to the parishes. At every level, we are moving together. And therefore, synodality for me is the way forward for the church. And I keep saying to journalists especially, you have to distinguish authentic synodality from contaminated synodality. Because a lot of topics that have come on the table that have nothing to do with synodality.
What would you say are some of those topics that were brought up during the first gathering of the synod? What was some of that contamination?
For example, you jump into the synod hall and you spend 2 days arguing about ordination of women. If they want to, those are things that belong to the Pontifical Theological Commission. Or LGBTQ, should I bless homosexuals or not? What has that got to do with being church, moving forward together, and a synodal church where everybody listens to everybody? Why do we spend 2, 3, 4 days arguing whether the word LGBTQ should enter the document or not? For me, these are distractions. If you go back and you look at some of the documents of which we have had, especially we look at Ecclesia in Africa, we look at Africae Munus. Those are documents which already laid a very strong foundation for a synodal church. If you look at the way John Paul presented the family from the African Synod, the church as family. In the family, you have thieves. The family, you have saints. It's the same family. And therefore, you are family. No matter who you are and what your orientation is, we are family. And therefore, this foundation already for a synodal church had been laid. Now we have to build on this foundation to walk together as family towards the kingdom of God. And all the theological topics that are being brought on, all the, you know, whether priests should marry or not, whether women should be priests or bishops, or whether angels are male or female, what has this got to do with synodality? So this is my point.
It's a good point. Some of the documents that have been produced since the first gathering of the Synod, one of them is Fiducia Supplicans, another one is Dignitas Infinita. One seems to be clarifying the other. You've made significant pronouncements, almost a rejection of, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, of Fiducia. In light of those two documents, what do you think you will be representing when you come into the second gathering of the Synod, or even in between?
As president of the Conference of Bishops in Cameroon, I signed a declaration of the bishops of Cameroon against fiducia supplicants. This had nothing to do with African culture, but it had something to do with the authentic teaching of the Catholic Church. At the time we all were ordained bishops, we took a vow, made the promise of upholding the deposit of faith and handing over this deposit of faith to the next generation, undiluted and uncontaminated. This is what we are talking about. It has nothing to do with my being African or not. And therefore, those who say that, oh, you see, the Africans, they don't accept this because of their culture, it has nothing to do with that. What has the church taught us for 2,000 years? And why are we, and who is trying to deviate us from this teaching of the faith of our fathers? This is our strong point. And therefore, we went into the arguments to say that fiducia supplicans is asking us to bless homosexual couples. And we have tried to make this very clear. Anybody who comes in front of me, I bless them. I don't make distinction who is who. I don't ask you what's your orientation before I bless you. No. But if two men come holding hands and a couple, our worry was with the word couple. And that is why we say this is a deviation from the authentic teaching of the Catholic Church. And the church is a divine institution run by human beings. We always have to look forward and looking at the church as the winner, not individuals.
EWTN News has a full slate of journalists covering next month's Synod on digital, print, and broadcast. Reporting has already begun in our sister publications, the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency.
They said, what are you going to do now? The vice president says she's not coming. I said, well, you know, we're not used to this.
New York's Cardinal Timothy Dolan on his podcast earlier this week discusses being, quote, very disappointed that Vice President Kamala Harris has turned down an invitation to the Alfred E. Smith Dinner. The 5,000-plate charity event has been attended by nearly every major presidential candidate since 1960 and raises millions of dollars for Catholic charities in New York. Colonel Dolan says Harris's decision to skip the dinner was not a wise political move. Harris's team says she'll be campaigning in critical swing states. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump will attend the dinner, which will be held on October 17th in Manhattan. New York City Mayor Eric Adams pleaded not guilty to federal charges of improper campaign contributions, bribery, and wire fraud. He surrendered to authorities on Friday. A five-count indictment outlines a decade-long trail of corruption, beginning from his time in office in Brooklyn through his mayoral administration. Prosecutors say Adams took illegal campaign contributions and bribes from foreign nationals in exchange for providing favors. Adams denies any wrongdoing and said during a news conference he does not plan to resign. A new survey of Catholics in the U.S. and in six Latin American countries reveals widespread dissent from church teachings. The Pew Research Center this week released their findings of a survey of more than 12,000 Catholics in the U.S., Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Peru about how the church should handle issues ranging from the priesthood to contraception. A majority of Catholics in every country except Mexico are in favor of allowing women to become priests. Support for that topic ranged from a high of 83 in Brazil to a low of 47% support in Mexico. The survey reveals most Catholics in all seven countries want the church to allow Catholics to use birth control. The highest support was in Argentina with 86% and the U.S. with 83% support. Pew also finds that most Catholics in the U.S. and in Latin America still view Pope Francis favorably, though those ratings have dropped over the years. In his native Argentina, Pope Francis's favorable rating has fallen from 98% to 74% over the past decade. Chile saw the second largest decline from 79 to 64%. A massive turnout of pilgrims last weekend at the Fatima Shrine in Portugal. An estimated crowd of 180,000 bikers participated in the ninth pilgrimage of the Blessing of Helmets. The bikers carried a statue of Our Lady of Fatima to the Basilica of the Holy Trinity, after which their helmets were blessed during Mass. The annual pilgrimage has become one of the biggest events at Fatima. Nearly 900 motorcyclists are either seriously hurt or killed annually in accidents in Portugal. During the pilgrimage, bikers ask for God's protection through Our Lady's intercession. The Vatican has announced the theme for 2027's World Youth Day in Seoul, South Korea. Take courage, I've overcome the world. Taken from the Gospel of John, the theme will focus on Christ's Paschal victory. World Youth Day gathers hundreds of thousands of young people from all over the world. This will be the first World Youth Day to take place in a predominantly non-Christian country. A new resource on EWTN helps families with little ones navigate the media landscape. The Is This for Kids podcast breaks down movies, apps, and more so that parents can find family-friendly content. The show recently looked at Monster Summer, a new independent film by Catholic actor David Henry, releasing on October 4th, just in time for Halloween. Henry recently told EWTN News he hopes the film will be a fun adventure the whole family can enjoy.
For me, I grew up watching a lot of movies with my dad, and it was very meaningful time we spent together, some of our most meaningful time, some of my best memories. And I felt like content back then, it was worry-free. There were no awkward car rides home, and it was some of the most meaningful time I spent with my father. Cut to today, I'm like, where are those movies? I really wanted to recapture that father-son or mother-daughter relationship in an event movie this Halloween.
You can hear more about Monster Summer on Is This for Kids at ondemand.ewtn.com. We'll be right back.
How sweet is the way of love? How kind is it that?
Up next, some sweet Christian music from singer Marie Miller as she sits down with me to talk about the inspiration for her latest album. Living as a professional musician is not all roses, but this week we introduce you to one singer-songwriter whose latest work has a patron saint guiding her along the way. Here is artist Marie Miller's faith journey in depth.
These are my little dreams.
Marie Miller is no stranger to the stage. The 35-year-old folk pop artist has opened for the Backstreet Boys, toured with Five for Fighting. She's even performed for Pope Francis.
You're not alone, you're not alone, you're not alone.
But I mean, maybe that was just another little tug on my heart that God was saying, you know, represent the church. That was super special.
Now, after nearly 20 years as a professional recording artist in the secular music world, Marie Miller is taking a leap of faith to be a Catholic artist.
You made this decision to pivot and step out faith first as this Catholic artist. Tell us about what went into that decision.
It came very naturally because I started writing for the next album, and I was writing about what I love and who I love most. And when I was writing that, I was thinking of my husband, but also thinking about our Lord and our Lady, and thinking about St. Therese, and thinking about these relationships that I had grown in as I've gotten older. And so I thought, well, I don't think that pop radio is gonna like a song about the Eucharist. Maybe they would. But it was just really easy for me to go, I wanna bring this to the church and hopefully bless bless the church with this new music.
This spring, Miller released her first faith album called The Way of Love.
The roads these feet have seen.
It's a collection of songs she hopes can be played either on the radio or on retreats. Lyrics focus on the Eucharist, women in scripture, and the title song, inspired by the 19th century French Carmelite and doctor of the church, Saint Therese of Lisieux.
How did you come to create The Way of Love?
So I was reading this beautiful quote, which is one of my favorite quotes now of all time, by Therese. And she says, "How sweet is the way of love." And I thought, wow, the way of love, doing everything for love, towards love. That's the way that I want to go.
How sweet is the way of love? How kind it is that...
The singer-songwriter says she developed a devotion to Therese in recent years, even giving a nod to her Little Way spirituality with her previous album title, Little Dreams.
Something that I love so much about her is her little way, right? And I think about, as an artist, I can focus on more likes, more followers, you know, bigger audiences, but that would be the opposite of Therese. Therese, who felt that it was okay to be little, and to think of each time I perform, whether it's for 20 people or 100 people, whatever it is that it's significant, because we need to do even the smallest things for love.
Committed now to using her God-given gifts for the Catholic Church, Marie Miller is taking her new album on the road with the Way of Love musical presentation, blending together song and the spoken word to present aspects of St. Therese's teachings.
For many years, I didn't really relate to St. Therese at all because I'm thinking she's lived this perfect life. She never committed a mortal sin.
Miller says this modern doctor of the church models to us how to accept God's mercy.
And so this way of love is a way for sinners. St. Therese can be a saint for sinners because it's about mercy.
What kind of personal encouragement does that give you as an artist?
Yeah, I have to say it is the only way that I can do this, is to know God's mercy, because I cannot come and say that I am holy enough or good enough to do any of his art. You know, it's his art. To talk about him, you know, is such a beautiful but kind of scary thing. You know, I'm writing songs about the Eucharist, about Our Lady, about Therese. And at first, I was afraid to do it because I just thought, I'm not good enough. And the merciful love of God, which is at the heart of the Theresian teaching, is about the merciful love of God. That is why I'm doing it, because I'm always hoping to point others towards him, not towards me.
With the help of the little flower, this artist is keeping her eyes on Christ instead of the charts.
But I hope that this music points towards something heavenly, and that people are reminded of the merciful love of God.
Never turning back.
The Way of Love is available on all streaming platforms. St. Therese, pray for us. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.